With Redefine Ed, the podcast, I'm Travis Pillow. This episode, guest interviewer Denisha Merriweather is back. This time she's talking with Gerard Robinson, former state schools chief from Florida and Virginia, and past president of the Black Alliance for Educational Options, to talk about the NAACP's latest stance on charter schools and what the education reform community can do to cultivate more Black leaders.
Hello and welcome to Redefine, your home for news about parental school choice and education reform.
Welcome to Redefine the podcast. Today we're talking with Gerard Robinson, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute who has previously led state education departments in Florida and Virginia, and who has been a leader in education reform organizations. This week, you are being featured as a guest blogger on Ed Week on a series called Unpacking the NAACP Charter Resolution. And some of the points you made was that the mission of the NAACP is being committed to public schools. And I really love a quote in the first part, which, and it said that the consistency of this position reveals that the NAACP believes that it can best champion its commitment to public education and Black children by opposing charter schools. What is the rationale of the NAACP's opposition for charter schools and school choice?
So the fact that I could become the Secretary of Education in Virginia and the Commissioner of Education in Florida as a Black man is because of the work of the NAACP and the Legal Defense Fund. When they decided to commit themselves to eradicating Jim Crow education from Southern schools, but also in the Midwest, New England, and the West, they said, we've got to make sure that we keep the spirit of Brown alive by making sure that whatever we do, it focuses on advancing public education for all kids at all times. With that being said, there are members of the NAACP who simply believe that charter schools are not really public schools, meaning they cream skim the best and brightest kids, they are exclusive and not open to all children, and that they divert money away from public education. If that's what you believe charter schools do, then I could surely see why you would be against charter schools.
Mm-hmm. And so the NAACP, they sued the New York City over charter schools in 2001, and you alluded to this also in your series, and they issued a statement supporting that, saying that it support parental choice, at least in theory. Are charter schools actually empowering Black students in practice, or are they supporting school students in what you call a liberty-based model of school choice?
Charter schools are supporting teachers, families, and Black children through a liberty-based model. When this movement began early 1990s, initially in Minnesota and then in California, the goal was real simple. We need to empower teachers so that they can empower students in their classrooms. We often forget that the first two states, again, charter states, being California and Minnesota, those charter laws were set up to give teachers the power to do that kind of work. A lot of teachers said, you know what, I'm doing great things in the classroom, but how much more could I accomplish if, in fact, I was free from some of the regulations that I have within the classroom? With the movement of charters beyond California, then the doors were open for community groups, parents, nonprofit organizations, and others to create charter schools. So charter schools, from its inception, has been in the liberty based camp. Mm-hmm. However, again, understanding that the NAACP believes opposite of that, they see charter schools as really nothing that's going to really help Black kids, which is why they're, as they would say, they're not so much opposed to charters as they are for parental options for all kids. It's a slight on word, but I understand their point.
So the NAACP, they're still in this fear-based a model that you talked about, but charter schools, they really are liberty-based.
I think that charter schools are liberty-based. I believe that the NAACP would see them more in the fear-based model. And when I say fear-based, for those who haven't read the pieces that you have, in 1956, 101 members of Congress signed what was called the Southern Manifesto, to basically say we're not going to allow the Supreme Court to tell us what to do with our schools. And from 1956 to 1969, the NAACP led a campaign, which they ultimately won in many states, to get rid of what I call fear-based freedom of choice. Fear-based means we want to keep kids segregated by race. We don't want parents to have an opportunity to send their kid to the type of school they want, integrated, non-integrated, or otherwise. And third, we basically want to use the public money the way we want to, even if it means closing black schools. And when people talk about New Orleans, for example, after Katrina, over 7,000 adults, primarily in the teaching force, lost their jobs. A lot of those were African Americans. And when when New Orleans opened up our charter schools, a lot of those African American teachers were not hired. There's some in the school reform movement who said, see, another opportunity that when major reform came, black teachers were put out the door, young white teachers, the less experienced, were brought to the classroom. Guess what? During the massive resistance movement in the South, we saw similar trends. And so I put in there the fear-based and liberty-based because the NAACP, in fact, is onto something. When they say they want to make sure that public schools are open to all kids, they're speaking from a standpoint of knowing that it wasn't always that way. And that if they see that kind of spirit cropping back up, they're going to attack it. And in their worldview, they see charter schools as part of that. I don't.
Yeah, I don't either. This is, I guess, the millennial side of me. I think that in our generation, we are, you know, very diverse and very changing and all about choice and giving every person an equal opportunity. And so I think that fear-based model, it did exist, like you said, but today I don't think it's very relevant.
It's interesting you've mentioned your millennial status. If you talk to people over the age of 50, their idea of school choice and reform is very different than your own. Mm-hmm. You grew up at a time where you could customize your phone, customize the type of courses you want to take, you could customize the food you want. So in your worldview, you exercise choice every morning you wake up. Well, there are generations of Americans on all racial, ethnic, and religious sides who did not grow up in America where choice was an everyday fact. So your supporting it has a lot to do with what I would call the generational divide on choice and understanding of liberty versus fear.
Most definitely. Here in Florida, we have a number of black pastors who support school choice, and these pastors are really they're really great. They understand the challenges of inner city schools, and they really have committed themselves to advocating for the tax credit scholarship. They've made their voice heard with our lawsuit that the teachers union and the NAACP have filed against the tax credit scholarship program here in Florida. And, it worked. So the NAACP, they get their financial backing from the teachers unions. And I think there is a little bit more going on here. Their mission is to advocate for black families and public education, which is really a great equalizer, but there seems to be a disconnect, you know, between the NAACP's position and the large number of families who actually favor charter schools and often vote with their feet for school choice.
Yeah, so Florida is a great example of school choice, what I would call parental choice in action. Years ago, when I was president of the Black Alliance for Educational Options, I had a pretty good relationship with then Representative Terry Fields, who actually introduced me to a number of pastors, as did Michael Benjamin and John Kirtley. And so when I actually lived in Tallahassee and had a chance to see more of the tax credit program, you know, I was blown away by the commitment of pastors, but also the commitment of the teachers and families who said, we want this school to work. And so I'm glad to see that move ahead. One thing I will say in terms of how we talk about funding and ideology, when I was the president of BAO, people would say, Gerard, now, your organization's mission is to help black low-income families with all options, and that includes public schools. And they said, however, you're getting money from Walton, you're getting money from Gates, you're getting money from organizations that really only support school choice. The same thing is said about us that we're often saying about, let's say, the NAACP. The fact that they get their money from the teachers union, therefore they must be, you're not saying this, they must be bought and sold. I think that in most movements, you have people who invest money that may agree with you on part A and part B. And so when I hear people say that about the NAACP, I say, well, let's stop for a minute. Our charter movement, tax credit movement, voucher movement, ESA movement, is also funded by people who don't give a great deal of money to public schools. So I say it cuts both ways. At least for me, I was committed to this issue before it was sexy, profitable, and philanthropists made it a living off of.
Awesome. In January, you and I, we both testified before the House Committee of Workforce and Education, and a lot of folks in on that committee, they really want to expand educational options across the nation. But most school choice proponents, they normally seek to reduce federal government control. What are the ways Congress can promote school choice in education without placing new mandates on states or school districts?
So you've got Congressman Messer out of Indiana, who started the Congressional School Choice Caucus. That was a move in the right direction because it opened up the door for members of Congress to say, you know what, I need to better understand what role the federal government can play in education. And by having a caucus where we can talk, we can debate, we can have speakers come in, I think that was a smart approach to thinking about this issue before taking the first step. Number two, you've got Representative Fox from North Carolina. She's taking a stronger leadership role in education. She recently had a meeting of a group of school reformers and those who support reform and choice. We had a conversation with her. We provided information on what, you know, best practices take place. But at some point, this is also an issue about ideology. Traditionally, Republicans want little to no government involvement in federal education, mostly because, you know, federal education or education is mentioned in the Constitution. For me, I take the approach there should be a federal role in education, a soft touch, not a hard touch, because I can tell you from a state level, there's simply some things I cannot do without support from the federal government. And I think there's a difference between federal support and federal coercion. I think the new ESSA law is moving more in the line of encouragement, trying to have the federal government and departments of ed, the state's partner, and I think that's a step in the right direction.
Okay, what does a soft touch look like?
Soft touch is if we have a DC voucher program that we should A, vote for it, B, provide the funds, and C, step back and let the local administrator who has a contract to actually work with the schools and the families take care of that. All I would want as a federal agent is a yearly update on how well students are doing with test scores and to make sure that our money is being spent well. Number two, if I want to put a pilot program in, let's say, Lake Charles, Louisiana, Gainesville, Florida, or Boston, Massachusetts, is to provide funding to make sure we hire one or two researchers to evaluate the program, hire an outside auditor to make sure the financials are together, and ask for an annual update, and 3 years later, take a look at the results. The federal government's got a lot of money. Sometimes it uses it greatly, sometimes not. I think by providing funds, providing guidance, hiring the right people to manage, and then stepping back, we can then say, you know what, we invested in three cities. 3 years later, here's the good, bad, the ugly. From what we've learned, Congress should do thus and so. But too often, and I'm a Republican, you know, so I'm speaking in terms of party politics, we don't want to give the 3-year investment to then look at 20 years, you know, from now. But again, that's just my point.
And so you talked about the DC voucher, and I do think that the DC voucher is a great example for all states to promote, you know, school choice. And it is backed by federal government. And this election season is very messy, and I don't think a lot of attention is being given to education policy. And the DC voucher is up for renewal this year. What's going to be at stake for the program if it doesn't get renewed?
So in 2009, I, Dr. Fuller, Kevin Chavis, Virginia Walton Ford, Daryl Ellison, and a few others, we actually staged a silent protest in front of the U.S. Department of Education because President Obama and Arne Duncan, who aren't, you know, big supporters of private school choice, huge supporters of public school choice, decided not to fund the program, and there were a few other challenges, but basically a number of kids lost their seat in the voucher program. We took this a silent protest stance, for us, it wasn't politics. It was just simply immoral to kick out kids from a program that A, already had funding, B, was not taking funding from traditional schools nor charter schools, and C, to see this more as a way of making a political, you know, push against charter, against vouchers. Long story short, a few weeks later, there were over 3,000 people, who went to a big rally that led to Congress decided to support it. So just know historically, there's always been an annual push to make this program work. Currently, for a set of reasons, BC program isn't supported the way that it should be. If the people want to know, does the program work, they should pick up a book authored by Dr. Thomas Stewart and Dr. Patrick Wolf. It's called The School Choice Journey, and they actually follow parents in the DC scholarship program for 5 years. Everything you want to know about that program is in there. It's successful, it works, and we should keep it and frankly expand it to more families.
The DC voucher, like you said, is fighting for his life, you know, in several programs, either in the Corps or in Congress, or a state legislator. In other programs, like the one in Louisiana, maybe forced to turn students away by budget cuts, and you just alluded to that. How can we create stability in school choice families so they know that their scholarship won't be taken away in the middle of the school year by lawsuits or by budget cuts or other acts of Congress?
So on the family side of the fence, whenever there's a legislative session and there's a hearing that's going to take place about the that voucher program in particular, someone from families or a group of families need to go to those meetings to testify, to say my child's in the program, here's why it works. And if they see things they don't like, they should say that as well, because not all, you know, choice programs do it equally well. So parents not only have to benefit for having the right to put their kid in there, they've also got to use what I would call their political responsibility to attend as many meetings as possible to let lawmakers know they matter. On the legislative side of the fence, parents and school reformers, when we craft legislation, we've got to try to find out a way, and I know each state law is different, we've got to try to find a way that the authorization for funding isn't an annual exercise. Can we get funding for 5 years and then revisit it every 5 years? I know it's tough, but we've got to push beyond the annual. From the regulatory side of the fence, once a law is signed by the governor, we traditionally throw confetti in the air. We're excited. The program is there. But guess what? That legislation now is going to go to a state regulatory agency, usually a Department of Education, or in the case of tax deduction, a Department of Revenue. And it's through the regulatory process where you shape, sometimes for good or bad, the intent of the legislature. I can tell you from personal and practical experience, we often don't see parents or reformers at our regulatory meetings where decisions are made. So I would push for parents and others to make sure we're at those meetings as well.
You were a former secretary in Virginia, so you really know the state well. It's also the home state of Tim Kaine, who's running for vice president and talked a little bit about education during the Democratic Convention. Do you think he might be on board with some of these ideas? And do you have any insight of where he stands?
So I wasn't in Virginia when he was governor, but I know a few things about him personally and professionally. I know he believes that education matters. Same thing with his wife. In fact, his wife until recently was the Secretary of Education for Virginia, and she's got a unique story in this state. She's married to a governor, but she's also the daughter of another Virginia governor who, when he took office, enrolled her into a public school, making her one of the first white kids to actually integrate Richmond public schools. So she's seen this also, she's a judge, she's seen this as well. He supports the concept of pre-K education. He thinks it's important. He took a stance to make sure that it's open to low-income families in Virginia, so he's good on that aspect. He's soft on the charter school piece. I don't think he's anti-charter school as much as he's pro-traditional public school. I don't think we can expect much from him to support a DC voucher program or really any voucher program. On the issue of education savings accounts, Florida being one of the five states with one, Ted Cruz introduced legislation to have a ESA for DC residents. I don't expect him to support something like that. But what I will say is he's a reasonable, thoughtful, smart person who understands politics, but he also understands social justice, part of it driven by his Catholic upbringing. So I think if he ends up becoming Vice President of the United States, it would behoove us as reformers to try to find ways to carve out space for him, because unlike who would then be, let's say, President Clinton, he's actually run a state. He knows how this makes sense, and I think he's someone we can work with. Won't agree on everything, but, you know, this is politics.
You're also president of Bayonne, and currently we see the organization going through a transition. Right now it's holding a nationwide competition for new leaders who might take the organization in a new direction. What kind of ideas do you hope might emerge from this competition that's going on?
So for 17 years, Bayonne has helped change how Americans think about parental choice in general. The fact that we use parental choice and not school choice is something that Bayonne helped shepherd. Not the only one, but one of the ones to do it in a very intelligent way. For 17 years, we've made sure the concept of low-income and working-class black families stay on the plate, because for a host of reasons, there could come a time when those constituents aren't considered. Where Bayonne is today is to say we need almost a, let's say, 2.0 model, meaning we're going to stay committed to our mission, to our purpose, and to our constituency. However, we need to bring in fresh blood and fresh thinking on how to use social entrepreneurial ideas to take the organization to the next level. Does that mean that we create a brand new app? Do we create a brand new organization? Do we keep what we have and strategically partner with organizations on the left or right? Do we create a totally virtual option? That's the great thing about the competition. There are several people sitting down right now who are thinking very deeply and differently about this than I ever did, who are going to enter a competition, and a new flower will unfold, and someone will say, ah, I never thought of that. But think about it. When have you seen a black organization put over $500,000 on the table saying, come to the table, help us think differently, and we'll invest in you? I think that says a great deal about Bayonne, but also the maturity level of the school choice movement that we can do something like this.
Yeah, and it's very innovative. What do you think makes Bayonne's voice unique and valuable in the national school choice debate? Do you think there is enough prominent black voices in the education advocacy world?
There are a lot more black voices in 2016 than 17 years ago. I think what made Bayonne unique is the fact that, you know, one founder, Dr. Fuller, was a former superintendent of schools in Milwaukee. So when someone, you know, says he didn't support public education, kind of tough to say that given the fact he was a superintendent. You had Dr. Deborah McGriff, who was the first female superintendent of Detroit Public Schools. Had spent a number of years working in public schools in New York City. She's also committed to public education. She's a founder. You have pastors, whether it was Bishop Brown or other pastor, Bernard Gantt, who is the director of urban education for one of the country's largest Christian school associations. You also had people who were politicians. And what people actually don't realize about Bayonne is that we had members who supported charters but hated vouchers. We had people who supported vouchers and tax credits, but hated charter schools. We had homeschoolers who said, we're just here because of homeschools. So there was really a diverse, you know, set of ideas, and contrary to, you know, popular belief, Bayonne was not a black Republican organization. Most of our staff were Democrats or independents. They surely were not Republicans. In terms of where we are today, I'm glad to see more young black voices in some positions of authority, in diverse organizations ranging from New Schools Venture Fund to Charter School Growth Fund to AFC and onward. What I would like to see next is to have more African Americans in positions of leadership at foundations, so that when multi-million dollar decisions are being made, we're at the table helping shape that conversation. I also would like to see more black philanthropists invest in this movement, because it makes it kind of tough from a symbolic standpoint, to say that we believe so much in black families, black children, black education, when in fact we don't have black people investing in this movement.
Mm-hmm.